Welcome everyone to the Dot Matrix at the dotmatrix.com and iTunes. I'm Justin.
I'm Sean.
And I just had to do it that way. Episode 26, and as Sean has just pointed out to me, it's exactly a month since our last podcast, so not exactly bi-weekly or whatever, but you know, it's not bad. It's the beginning of the summer. We are allowed a little bit of a you know,
a little respite.
Respite. Speaking of respite, this is the first time since we've ever started the podcast where I didn't go to the washroom directly before the podcast. So whoa. We'll see if it works.
Are you going to make it through?
Let's hope.
Is your shirt RW and Company?
Yes, my shirt is RW and Company.
Nice. No, we were in there the other day and I thought I saw this one, or one like it. Nice colors.
Yeah, I thought I'd go a little bit bolder for those of you on the bus or listening to us on your iTunes, wherever you are. I am wearing a, what color is this, green? Is this green?
It's like a greeny gray.
Greeny gray.
Yeah.
Shirt.
Yeah. Wow. That's excellent. And I've got my, speaking of t-shirts, actually, that's kind of funny. I've got my Psychopathy Red shirt from the Slayer concert that I went to with our friend Kev.
Yes. Now, I heard that the crowd wasn't huge. Was it?
No. oh, yes. And this brings up a topic that I want to talk about.
Okay.
Ticketmaster.
Ticketmaster.
Their infinite wisdom.
Okay, just get it right
okay,
into
ready
it.
Ready for this?
Yes, yes, please.
Okay, well, it's about this Slayer show. So Slayer and Megadeth in Vancouver, June 24th. Just happened last week.
Okay.
I was really excited to go. Kevin and I went. And we had a great time. But get this. Day before the show, I get an email from Ticketmaster saying, you have been upgraded. Did I not tell you this story?
No, I don't know the story.
Okay. The thing is, who gets an email the day before the show saying your tickets have been upgraded and the ones you currently have in your possession are now void?
Ugh.
Yes. And I was like, oh, upgrade. That's interesting. Let me check out where it was. Well, it was actually further from the stage. It was in the lower bowl of GM Place, which we have here, which is our
hockey arena, basically.
Hockey arena. And we were on the third row of the upper balcony, but way closer.
Okay.
Now, we were 16th row of the lower floor, lower bowl, directly across from the stage, like the furthest point from the stage.
Right.
Arguably, I don't think that's better.
No,
and
but it's probably a better price point, though, right? It's probably a more expensive ticket. Like, that's what they probably define it as, probably? No, or no, it's still the same
price range.
Oh, well, that's awful. Sorry, it's...
That's the crazy thing.
Okay.
And not only that, tickets I have are... can't get into the show with them. So I either got to somehow find a way to print these out, or they... Or I didn't know how to get them, because it said log on and get them. I couldn't figure out how to do it. And I'm pretty good with internet, you know?
It's not too foreign for you.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so I, not thinking that, thinking in case this is spam, I phone Ticketmaster.
Right.
I get this woman in Ottawa just before they close.
Okay.
And I explain the whole situation. She's like, whoa, that doesn't sound like better seats to me.
Right.
So she's like, we're talking about it. And then she goes, oh, you know, I'm checking around. And I actually see some even better seats, like way closer to the stage. Eighth row on the lower bowl, so, you know, pretty good view.
Right.
Pretty good straight-on view.
Yeah.
And you know, it was only two tickets, so I was like, wow, really? And she's like, you know what, I can cancel your so-called upgraded ones. And that's two pairs that are canceled, and I'll see if I can get you exchange for the two seats in this new section.
Okay.
And I thought, okay, it's kind of a gamble, like, day before the show, is this going to happen?
Right.
So she says, there is an exchange fee of $10 per ticket. And I said, fine. But then she says that she says, yep, I talked to the supervisor, we can do it. And here's your new total. And the total was like dozens more than what my original total was. So I said, wait a second, is this the higher price range?
Right.
And she goes, oh, oops, it is. There's three price ranges. I had the middle one, and now I have the top price range.
Oh, God.
But then, do you know what I'm thinking?
Okay.
My first tickets are gone.
Yes.
I can't do anything about that. she already canceled the second tickets.
Yes.
Even if there was a way to reverse that, they're worse than the first ones. I bit the bullet and I said, you know what? Let's just do it. And she waived the exchange fee.
Okay. Yes.
Minimal, you know. She was trying to help me.
Yes.
But she jumped the gun. She was super nice, though. Anyway, but it's Ticketmaster's fault in the first place.
Yes.
Because what if I didn't see the email? What if I got this automatic phone message on myself? What if I was out of town until, like, the day of, and I just...
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a million scenarios.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it turns out that when I went to the show, there was no one at the Higher Bowl.
They locked it off,
They
right?
locked it off.
Because it... Okay, yeah.
The Lower Bowl was almost completely filled. So it made for a good show. A lot of people were really into it, but...
Right.
But I was like, that's a weird tactic. An upgrade to me is... Better price range.
Yeah.
Better seats.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you know what I'm saying? So, anyway, I thought that was funny. I thought you'd probably feel outraged by that.
That's awful. I mean,
it's typical yeah. bad corporation move, you know?
Yeah.
So.
And I think, you know, and I think what you do in those situations, I don't know, maybe it's not the right thing to do, but I just think everyone just fills in your seat as you've bought your ticket, and then if it's obviously really weirdly set up, there's like five people sitting in your whole row, and then, you know, after like the first act or whatever, then everyone just... Because there was four acts, wasn't there, or something?
Yeah.
Like, and then everyone just said, you know, we're all going to move down, just find a seat wherever you want, you know what I
yeah.
mean? Like, and just be communal about it instead
yeah.
of all this stuff, right?
Yeah. I was pretty shocked. If it was minimum a week earlier, then I would have been a little more open.
Right.
A week
yeah.
to sort this out. But the day before the show, they expect me to, you know, and in the email, they said, you will get these tickets the way you got your originals. Well, I got my original regular mail. She says, and she had to, the woman from Ticketmaster had to email me a PDF to print out the tickets. It was a full page document you had to print.
Right.
I had to take two full page letter sized documents, which was mostly commercials.
Right.
And at the top was this little ticket that they scanned. Can you believe that? Anyway, so that was my crazy story for last week. Ticketmaster fiasco indeed.
Yeah, that's what I've written down. I'm going to call it Ticketmaster.
But
fiasco.
The funny thing is, though,
indeed.
The new seats were great. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I would have been happy with the first seats, not the second seats. But I was really happy with the third seats, but I ended up paying more. But in the end, I had a, like, excellent time.
Right.
So it's...
And is that video posted on Facebook from Kev?
No, I don't think so. I haven't seen anything about it. We'll have to ask him.
So that was topic one.
Yes.
That's outrageous.
Isn't that just so shitty? They're a shitty company, man. For the record, they suck. Anyway.
Well, and I mean, I saw in the news too, because the only reason why I knew that the ticket sales weren't so great, and which is what led to your whole story about closing the Upper Bowl, was that there was a story on the news the other day saying that the Jonas Brothers were in town, but they were having a hard time selling tickets.
Oh, you're kidding?
Yes, because there were two nights apparently here, and they're not selling tickets, and it's the economy, and people just don't have the discretionary income to see this
crap
band or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And they mentioned Slayer was the Slayer show also, and Megadeth had a tough time selling tickets too, they said on the story. So I was like, oh, that's the thing that Sean was at. And and they're basically saying, for the last decade or probably two decades, ticket prices have steadily gone up and up and up to sort of an outrageous level. Mm-hmm. Almost artificial level, like housing market, right?
Yeah, totally.
And now ticket prices should probably go down.
Well, I think they would, because when you think about it, for me, the tickets were actually pretty good priced, I thought, because those are two of the biggest names in metal.
Right.
And I was very shocked to see that, like, I've seen Slayer do the GM Place before with a bunch of smaller bands, and it was the same, about the same.
Right, but to have the extra double bill kind of thing.
I was shocked. Yeah. Shocked. So, but that's the way it goes, I guess.
Yeah. So I think they're going to have some experiences like this with concert promoters and organizers, where they're going to, you know, eventually, you know, bring down the prices probably substantially. You know, just, I mean, I think you rather sell more tickets at a lower price, you'll get better overall revenue anyways for your show than keeping a artificially higher price range. But anyways.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
That's just supply-demand estimations, you know?
And yeah.
They just want to make music.
Yeah. I was pretty stunned.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else is on your list? As I have absolutely nothing on my list, but I'm sure things will come up.
You know, I mean, there's a lot happening in the last month since we talked. I know.
Yes. Can I just say the last thing?
Yeah.
The first thing or the most recent thing
is
I checked the NewYorkTimes.com website
before
I came, and apparently Al Franken was named the senator in Minnesota, finally. After
what is that, 8 months?
Yeah, yeah.
It's huge. I'm surprised it took that long.
How many votes? How long does it take to count votes? You know, like.
Is it just appeals and.
Yeah, it's various different appeals or something in the court, so.
Well,
but I thought that was kind of interesting. So
I think that's hilarious. One more on the Dem side. That means that they have even more sway, I guess, in the House. No.
Well, they said that they have 60 votes now, which is enough they need to block any Republican filibustering, which is blocks the whole legislative process.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they said that they just in total have 60, but they're going to rarely get 60 because Kennedy is gravely ill and doing cancer treatments and for brain cancer, and then this other old Democrat guy is on his way and had a staph infection, was like in for a month in hospital. Yeah. So whether they can actually get all 60 Democrats to be there in the House to sit at one time is kind of highly doubtful. So so if they had like 63 or something, then they'd be for sure, right? But yeah, so
interesting.
But anyways, that was that topic, and, but yes, keep going.
Well, I was thinking, you know, the two biggest things are obviously the unrest in Iran.
Yes.
And obviously the passing of Michael Jackson. You can't do a podcast without talking about that, because that only happened like 5 days ago.
Right. That and Farrah Fawcett and Ed McMahon.
And Billy Mays.
Yes! Yes!
Yes. A lot of people. Yeah, OxyClean, yes. So, I was thinking there was that, and then there was another thing that I found really interesting in the McLean's. I don't know if you had seen it, but this Harvard psychologist, Gene Heyman, talking about addiction not being, like, substance addiction not being a disease, but a matter of personal choice.
Interesting.
Yeah. Now, I read the article in McLean's, which is our national news magazine, I guess you could say.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people wrote in letters, and I tend to agree. Like, whether you agreed with his opinion or not, he didn't seem to be actually backing it up with a lot of hard data.
Right, okay.
So, I don't know. And he hasn't actually, apparently he hadn't worked with a lot of people who suffer from those.
So he's a psychologist, okay.
He's a psychologist, yeah, so. But essentially, he's saying, the bottom line of this was, you know, in the last 20 years especially, it's been about addiction being an illness and da-da-da-da, but, or disease, for lack of a better term. But what he's saying is that he's finding that when they overcome drug addiction or alcohol addiction, it's due to a lot of choices they had to make because of the consequences they could potentially suffer. For example, losing a great job, losing family, the list goes on. Like a financially hit, you know, feeding your habit, you know, and things like that.
Right. Okay.
Losing your job, you know, say you're a pilot or whatever, you would actually probably, but you could maybe look at taking a serious stab at ending your addiction cold turkey rather, you know, than risk losing your pilot license, for example. I think, you know, things like that, like when people see the consequences, they find that they can turn off the addiction more than just labeling it simply an illness and whatever comes with that. It was very kind of vague.
Well, see, like, I don't mind if someone wants to say that as a theory and just sort of have it as a theory, right?
Yeah.
You know? But then I wonder, well, what happens? So, okay, I see where he's coming from in terms of the you do have to want to get rid of your addiction, right? But they always say that as a you know, I don't know who they are, but you know, like,
yeah,
you know, addiction, people who work in addictions, counseling and so forth, they all, people a lot of times talk about the need to want to quit. If you don't want to quit, it's
never going to happen.
It's never going to happen, right? So, you know, I see where you could take that notion and maybe make that argument, right?
Yeah.
But, like, I don't know, like, but my thinking is let's say I'm a supermodel, okay? And you're not going
to... you are. You already are.
Oh, Sean. But, you know, I'm not going to go the way where you think I'm going to go. But let's say, you know, and suddenly I get third-degree burns, right? Yeah. Or something, right? I'm not talking to talk about bulimia or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But, like, you know, mm-hmm. just... I mean, that's what came to my head. Like, what happens... Mm-hmm. You know, you're a supermodel in your job, and you get third-degree burns. Mm-hmm. And, well... it's a medical condition. You have third-degree burns.
Right.
Right? Right. And you can choose to just let it heal naturally or, you know, and then be disfigured. Or you can choose to get plastic surgery or to do some sort of medical procedure to solve that, to fix that medical condition, right? But, you know, just because you choose that I've decided to, the solution is surgery or cosmetic surgery, just because I chose that, does that now mean that the third degree burn is a personal choice? I don't think so.
Right. Totally.
You know what I mean?
I know. It opens up a lot of can of worms, really.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it works in a particular context mm-hmm. with addictions where the choice is a pivotal part of your recovery. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of other things, medical conditions, where your choice, it's not you know what, the choice was whether or not it happens or not. It's not whether or not the success rate or not. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, I don't know.
I think when he's, you know, like, he got a lot of, there was a lot of feedback on this.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of medical professionals like, no, this is an illness and this is why. And other people are like, you know, I'm so glad someone's come out and said it. You know, this is a personal choice that people are making. They are choosing to do these substances and which is, I think, kind of a hard line.
Yeah.
He's not disputing that people end up in trouble where it's difficult to get out of. He's not saying that, okay. but I think a lot of people took what he was saying and kind of maybe took it a bit far.
Yeah. I think there's a middle ground, probably.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's hard to, for anything, especially addictions, where it's so how people become addicted to something can take many reasons and many forms, you know, many pathways to get to addiction, mm-hmm. that it's hard to be a global blanket thing about, oh, well,
oh,
you know.
Yeah.
So it's not an easy one.
But I've always never been, I mean, I've never been comfortable with saying it's a choice and sticking with that, but I've never been totally comfortable with the word illness either.
Okay.
Because when I think illness, I think, like, an affliction.
Yeah.
For lack of a better term. I think of, like, you know, there's so many things, illnesses that you can do things to prevent them. And there's illnesses that, you know, there's so many different illnesses that one person could potentially get that there was no way to prevent it, arguably, you know?
Right.
And it can just happen to you. And I don't think sometimes drugs is really that same type of thing, alcohol and drugs. Like, illness, you're sick when you get there. But, you know, like, this is going to sound funny, but, you know, when people are like, oh, you know, I ended up on heroin and, you know, it's illness, I'm addicted, da da da. Well, it's like, well, that's a major decision to make, to do something like heroin for the first time. Do you know what I mean?
Right, it's not something you just stumble upon and decide, yeah. Oh, I wonder what this is, and, yeah.
Knowing what we know today,
the
right?
pathway to that is deliberate. That's true.
But what is also not deliberate is what puts a person in that mental frame of mind. And I think that's what he's getting. He's kind of like, you know, if I paraphrase or whatever, but he's kind of like, you know, obviously we're never looking at what gets people to do such a thing and, you know, make those choices. After right. you've made that choice and you're hooked, obviously it's not much of a choice anymore because you can't help but do it. And I think there's something real behind that.
Right.
I don't know if illness is the right term. You know what I mean?
That's interesting. When you said all that, what came to my mind is that the label of whether or not addiction is an illness or not has nothing to do with the individual, I think. Like, for me, the power in that label, I mean, everything you say is like, you know, what depending on what side of the argument you fall on, you will agree or not agree, or or I think you were pretty balanced in what you said, right? So I don't, like, I think that's, I think any either side you could see, oh yeah, yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. But what I think the label is more important for is not necessarily about the individual. Like, if I'm addicted to heroin, I don't care. In some ways, whether or not I call it an addiction or whether or not I call my addiction medical or not, I mean, it has a certain relevance to me personally, right?
Right.
But the label has more importance socially or community-wise or societal-wise, because if it's just a personal choice, I've already made a, you know, by just saying just in front of that personal choice, I've made a social context of what I believe that means. So if it's a personal choice, then I'll look at, as a society, we'll look at addiction as, well, that's Sean's problem. He's addicted to heroin. It's his choice and his responsibility to get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe with personal choice, you have a society that's more, you know, empathetic, like it is in here in Canada, that maybe the personal choice would still, that label would trigger social services or, you know, counseling or more of the services provided by the social services sector, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But when you call it an illness, then it doesn't preclude the social services treatments that you could get. But in addition to that, society allows you to partake in medical treatments.
Absolutely.
So it adds more tools to your toolkit to solve your addiction.
Right, right.
So when you said that, that sort of came, that's what processed in my mind, that the label is more about what society allows the individual to have access to solve that problem, I think, more than the individual label.
Right.
So
right.
I think for me, whether or not I don't disagree with some of your points, right? Which would side, let's say, some of your points sided on personal choice, while some of it sides on illness, right?
Yeah.
And for me, it's sort of like, as a society, I would rather it still be called an illness, so that way everyone who's going through an addiction has all the tools possible. And sometimes it will only be social services or counseling or something. But sometimes some people will need that at their medical treatment of some kind, right?
Right.
And if you keep the label medical, then at least it leaves it that as a possibility. But if you start taking it away, society in general believes it's only a personal choice, then you remove that those processes and those, say, safety nets or those possible solutions. They are completely out of reach, right? So I don't know, that's sort of what came to my mind.
No, and that's a really good point. I think that's really what I don't think the average person thinks about that a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
Because what you're saying is what could happen is it becomes pretty Thatcher-esque, right? Which is very Harper-esque. Because Harper, and this is a funny little tidbit, but Harper's a Thatcher fan.
Oh,
he's
okay.
From that neocon type of mentality.
Right.
John Baird, who's now the transportation minister.
Yes.
You know, he's the kind of the bulldog and pit bull.
Yes,
in
yes.
In the house. He is a Ronald Reagan fan.
Really?
Because I saw this little thing on the Globe where they were, the Globe and Mail, online, where they had a video, they were interviewing him about the stimulus or whatever before the Ignatieff was thinking of bringing him down.
Right, right.
And they mentioned the fact on his desk it shows a little thing that says, a quote, "It can be done," which is something apparently Ronald Reagan said often.
Okay.
He's a huge fan of Reagan. So it's like, this is it, guys. This is where our federal government are coming from. Neoconservative politics from the last 20 years in the States and Britain. Or more. 30
oh, boy.
Years. Just so everyone's aware. Anyway.
Oh, interesting. That's an interesting point. I hadn't even, I hadn't even thought about this area of conversation in a while. So it's good you brought that up. That
was really interesting. Yeah, we haven't touched on this kind of stuff in a while.
Yeah.
It's more social kind of aspect.
Well, and our podcasts have lately been fairly political because that's what's been going on in the world, right?
Yes.
So it's nice to sort of have that other broader discussion. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah, and then, well, parlaying addiction into, you know, of course,
Yes, Michael Jackson. I was thinking, let's go there.
I don't know about you, but I'm still, like, I think about this a lot. I think just being a musician and you're a musician.
To a lesser extent.
You know,
in a former life.
Okay, let's say it that way.
Sure, cool.
But as an active musician, I and someone who grew up on Thriller, like from an early age,
yeah.
I was affected by this, and I was very saddened by it, and I, even after all the controversy and all the weirdness, and when it all comes down to the music, and that music is hard to beat in a lot of ways. So I don't know what your thoughts on the whole thing are, but...
Well, a couple of comments I thought were kind of interesting that I've seen the last couple of days. One where I watched The Daily Show last night. And,
oh, yeah.
And he said, you know, at a certain point, you know, it's kind of fun and quirky to sort of give people nicknames, you know. But once someone is dead, maybe you should stop using Jacko. And there was this whole, like, one of those New York tabloids that said Jacko something. He's like, can a brother get a Mr. Jackson, you know? So I thought that was an interesting comment about sort of, you know, the kind of respect you provide. I mean, the kind of press he's getting last week is very different than the press he's been getting for the last year or something, right? Or in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And another thing, I was watching Countdown with Keith Olbermann.
Okay.
MSNBC. And just watched the very, very beginning of it. And he was talking about today on the show. And again, Michael Jackson was made the headlines of that. And he said, they showed a clip of Michael Jackson's father.
Yes.
His first reaction, like, a few days ago. And then, again, yesterday, he was more sort of talking about the mourning of his son or something. But the first comment was, you know, when they asked Michael Jackson's father for a comment, Joe Jackson said, the world's lost a big superstar. We're all mourning the loss of the biggest superstar in the world. And then you can hear Keith Olbermann say, your son? And how that comment was very odd, like such an odd distance to that comment for someone who's supposed to be this, like, I don't know, like if I had a child and my child was the world famous inventor of whatever or something, and then it suddenly passed on, I'd grieve my son before I grieve the inventor or the fame, right? So that was kind of interesting. And I'm sure, you know, Joe Jackson got some comments about, next time you say something, call him your son, maybe, you know? Yeah. So that was two comments that I thought was interesting over the coverage in the last couple of days. Mm. But my sister and I had a really strong conversation about this when it happened. She asked me a question was, her question was, so what do you think about this? Like, I mean, do you feel... like his legacy of his music versus this last number of years. And people have been talking a lot about this. Right? Mm-hmm. What's it, you know, can you separate the man from the music and the craziness of the skin color and the pajamas in court and the molestation charges? You know, I mean, is all of that, which has been the press for him for the last, you know, 10 years. And his career hasn't really been stellar, although he sells out shows.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's not like it was with Thriller and Beat It and all that sort of stuff, right?
Right.
And I said to my sister, I said, no, I think he's pretty iconic. Like, like he defined a generation, a music genre, what have you, that over time, that's what's going to win over. And even now, people are talking about that. And, you know, it's already taking hold. People aren't talking about his pajamas and his, I mean, to the same degrees as they, or the same kind of venom as they were in the past.
Right.
So, I said, it's different than, let's say, like, when Charlton Heston died. Mm-hmm. You know, like, he was a well-respected actor. Everyone knows who he is. But kind of frankly, you know, pry it from my cold, dead hands. You know, Charlton Heston being a gun nut is really what his legacy is, I think.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate. We talked about this, too, I think, when he died on our podcast.
That's right.
But Michael Jackson, it's you know, it's he was a preeminent musician of his time, of his genre, right? Charlton Heston was just a good actor. You know, pretty famous, but it's sort of like, I said to Vanessa, like a Paul Rudd versus a George Clooney. If George Clooney died, it'd be a different kind of mourning than if a Paul Rudd died.
Yeah.
And not to say anything against Paul Rudd, but, you know, like,
but it's that's a, just the way it
it's
is.
It's just the way it is, right? So that was sort of some of my thinking about that. You know, I don't know.
Like, no, you're totally right. I mean, they are coming out and there are people saying, look, guys, look at the musical legacy here, you know, and the extraordinary amount he's done for notably children's charities. You know, I think in the next few years, several years, it's a lot of this is going to be about his posthumous record sales, about sorting out his estate, his finances,
yes,
his kids, where they're going. Apparently, his mother has temporary custody, which is probably the best thing. But, you know, it's, you know, like Elaine's like, did you hear today? They want to have a 30-car motorcade go down through Los Angeles, you know, when they get this funeral up and running and stuff. And it's like,
right.
It's like, yeah, this guy is up there with any, and I've mentioned to you this before on the weekend, like he's up there with any world leader or any, he's a international figure. Like this isn't just some movie star who passed. Like, and you know, and that's sad for a lot of people because of who they touch. But this guy is as big as they get.
Yeah.
He just is. And that's what that means. And I think people, after all this, his estate and all that sorted out, are going to go back to the music and be like, holy shit, this is amazing music. You know? Like, notably, Off the Wall, Thriller, and Bad. Those three albums, for sure. People are going to be like, I still can't believe what he accomplished, him and Quincy Jones, with those records, you know? So I think it's going to come back to the music, but I think it's just really sad. It's a typical Elvis ending.
Yeah.
They're going to...
Second autopsy and...
Toxicology is going to be insane. They're going to find... You wait what they find in him.
Right.
Know? And the state that his body was in, completely underweight, just fragile, all sorts of health issues they already know about. I mean, it's just awful, you know? It's really sad.
Well, the last thing I thought was kind of interesting, and it's not to diminish anything about Michael Jackson's musical career and spanning, like, decades, you know?
Oh, God, yeah.
Many decades, you know, in terms of, you know, defining music in the 70s and in the 80s and then in some degree the 90s as well. But some of the real, I mean, and it's hard not to heap really high praise, you know, shortly after a person dies, you know?
Right, right.
About, you know, he was the first black superstar, people were saying. And I'm like, in a global sense, in how superstar is defined today, that is true.
Uh-huh.
And then he talks about, you know, they talk about, you know, I don't know, people have talked about that, and I just thought, well, that, I mean, that's true in many senses, but I just keep thinking, but it's hard to say that without diminishing some of the groundbreaking things that happened before him, right? Like, when you think about, like, yes, when he became a superstar in the 80s with all of his music, the whole world was now listening to that music, right?
Yeah, that's right.
As opposed to, let's say, you know, when I think about the big band era, right?
Yeah.
When, at that time, you know, the big bands were all white, you know, or like majority white, you know, all that we, you know, you and I being some sort of jazz history, you know, knowledgeable in the jazz history stuff.
Yeah.
You know, you got your Benny Goodmans, your Gene Krupas, your Dorsey. Buddy Riches and Dorsey's and stuff like that. And that was the music, at least of the continent at the time, and probably in Western Europe too, maybe not, you know, India and stuff, right? But for the majority of, like, the Western world, that was the music of the time. And yet there were superstars like Duke Ellington that everyone was listening to, Count Basie, everyone was listening to. So, you know, and you all the stories about Oscar Peterson and the Jazz at the Philharmonic and all they're doing around race relations in that time, right? Mm. Like... when people say he was the Michael Jackson was the first, it's hard to say that without diminishing all of that. And I
absolutely,
and I think of that time, and you think about superstars, Duke Ellington was probably a superstar as defined in that moment, right? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting. Like that was my first reaction to that. Again, not to diminish what Michael Jackson did too, but
But I think that way when people say those things, absolutely.
So I thought that was kind of interesting. And it said, like, Michael Jackson was the first black superstar to hit MTV or something. But I'm like, I don't know, how old was MTV even before Michael Jackson? I don't really know, so I thought that's kind of interesting.
Michael, I heard someone on the radio, and I agree with this, say that there wouldn't be MTV without Michael Jackson.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I can't even think of who was a big superstar on MTV even before Michael Jackson. Like, he was the first.
There was a few videos, but then within a year, you had Billie Jean, Beat It, Thriller.
Yeah.
Without the Thriller album, MTV wouldn't have made the strides it did.
Yeah.
And now it's some... Yeah.
So that's what I just thought was odd, how people say he was the first black superstar on MTV. No, he was the first superstar on MTV.
Oh.
Like, forget about any adjective before that. He was, like, the biggest thing.
And that's the other thing, you know, I heard someone talking about how, you know, especially with the Thriller video, every video he did got bigger and bigger and more expensive to create, you know, like hiring John Landis, director, and they spent over $1 million at that time, like almost 30 years ago, making the Thriller video, 14-minute video, that was like unheard of at the time.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah.
So, and it was, you know, like, shot like a movie, you know, like it looked like a movie, seen from a movie.
Right.
And so he was constantly trailblazing. And I think people deep down know that, whether they're saying it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think it's a huge tragedy, but not altogether surprised in some ways, because I mean, his last album of original material was like 8 years ago. It didn't make that huge of a splash in comparison with his other records.
Yeah.
And he's been all about the controversial headlines in the last decade, right? So, I don't know.
It will be interesting what we talk about a year, 2 years, 5 years from now about Michael Jackson. Because I think time will sort of help dissipate a lot of that crap of the tabloidness, right? Like, yeah. I mean, and maybe some of it has value, and not value, but truth to it. And I'm sure some of the tabloids never hurts anyone anyway, in terms of, like, record sales or your business. It never hurts to be in the paper somehow, right? Like, top of mind. But hopefully now some real serious discussion can happen about the impact he has, right? And I think it's starting to happen, so.
Which is good. Well, yes. Well, the only other thing I had was a ran.
You don't want to talk about the South Carolina governor? Going to Argentina? Oh. Just kidding.
Well,
this is much more interesting than that.
Well, I'll tell you, I it's funny you bring that up, because how many more governors or senators or, you know, these assholes have to go down before, you know, they start cleaning up house in the American governmental system? I mean, this guy, you know what? I don't think most people give a shit if he goes and he falls in love with a friend from another country. Who cares that it's Argentina? Who cares that it's another woman? If he runs the state, and this goes back to, like, Clinton and all this kind of other stuff, if he runs the state the way it should be run and people the way people in that state want, then fine. But where he really messed up was leaving without putting anyone in charge.
Yes.
You can't do that. Even though there's protocol... Should something happen when they know what to do, but you can't leave and not say where you're going. You know what I mean? Like, what?
Like, it's one thing if you are, I don't know, late night clerk at the Max, you know, to go away for 5 days and maybe not be in touch. But, you know, governor of a state in the United States of America, you should not be out of contact or out of cell phone range, you know?
No.
Check in on your Twitter occasionally, please, you know? Anyways, but I don't even want to give that much airtime because it's so stupid.
It really is just so stupid.
Yeah. But Iran, which I find fascinating.
Yeah.
Again, it's one of those topics where I don't know much about the history of Iran to sort of talk about it with any sort of authority. But I do find what everyone is finding. Which is, the fascinating use of technology and Web 2.0 to really get the story out and to get the images out, and it's making, you know, blackouts almost irrelevant and impossible. I find, like, yeah, I mean, I too wonder the validity of the election, given that there was such a strong opposition. How can a vote end up being 2-1? Like, it's, or, you know, even a landslide victory when it was a clear, you know, opposition party force and with some popularity. So you wonder about that. So I really, yeah, just, but I can't speak at all with any sort of authority on the issues at hand, but I do find the web and the internet angle of the story very fascinating. Although for me, just by focusing on that, I feel I'm giving the topic and the, you know, the whole issue a disservice by focusing on that little piece of it. You know what I mean? Mm. But anyways, I don't know. But you probably know. You're much more bigger history buff than I am. So.
Well, I mean, I think in the context of history, and especially in the last 60 years, I think this is pretty major. And I think that, you know, what some opinions are saying, which I don't disagree, is that, you know, that the rest of the world can be there as a support, you know, as much as you can without actually going in there and trying to shake things up, you know, like overthrowing, like they've done in the past, and where has it got us, right?
Right.
They did that 30 years ago, exactly, and where did it get us? It got us with basically frozen relationship with that state since. So, well, we didn't overthrow them, sorry, in 79, but...
We being the United States?
We being just North America and our relations with them since the U.S. overthrew their leader years and years ago. So, like, going even further than that. So it's just like, I think if people can start to keep saying the images, if governments, head of states, can keep applying the pressure, and not for a week, I'm talking ongoing. Because there's all these other issues happening, like the nuclear proliferation issue, which they think is happening.
Right.
There's just, you know, the whole issue with them backing Syria and Hezbollah and their hatred for Israel. There's a bunch of issues, but I can't help but think that nothing there is going to change until the people there keep pressing on and forcing it. And it's going to mean casualties, unfortunately, like we've seen. But I don't know, you know, if their sovereignty is respected and people don't go in there, like they've done in Iraq, and we see what happened there, you know, that country's going to have to sort itself out and, or be the status quo. It's their choice. And I think it's really up to the people, because there's more than them than there are secret police and government officials. It would get bloody, but I don't see any other way. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, the kind of protests they're making now really only comes around like once a decade,
right?
And it happens, and then it just eventually ends, and they can either eventually let it end like they usually do, or keep pushing really hard but I think Iran's leaders are realizing, though, with the technology, like you're mentioning, that they won't be able to suppress them like this forever. And right. I think they know that inside. Back in the 50s, back in the 60s, 70s, even, they could get away with this shit because, yeah, we had TV, but we didn't have an eye into that country like we do now. And I think, same with North Korea. It might take longer with North Korea because they're just so goddamn stubborn. But they're not going to... No country is going to be able to be truly isolated like they are now forever. It's just impossible.
Right.
You just can't, because there's going to be so much world trade and partnerships happening that economic relationships that are already there, they're only going to increase, that you're either with... You know, and it sounds like a stupid Bush statement, but you're either with the world, or you choose not to associate with the rest of the world, you know?
Right.
And right now, there's you know, there's like a handful of countries that just choose not to. They choose to just be so isolated and not wanting to bother with the rest, the way the rest of the world conducts themselves. So, I don't know. I think change is possible, and I think it's really sad how they're being, you know, oppressed and stuff. But I think if they just keep going, and hopefully they can, things can start to, little by little, inch by inch, turn around there. I don't know. That's why I can't help but think.
Hmm. Cool.
Yeah. I just want to see any more videos like that woman who died, who was shot. Yeah. That's just awful. So,
Well, on that note.
Yeah. Let's say something happy to end it off.
Well, I don't know if it's happy, but I'm really hungry. I got this weird stomach pain now that I just didn't have until the last 2 minutes or so. I got really quiet because I was like, oh, I'm hungry.
Well, I'm going to Vera's. So.
Oh, you are?
I'm going to pick up Vera's across the street, yeah. Oh. It'll be good to iron strength for my bike ride later, so.
Nice. You know, I'm...
You may want to join me on that. If you have a moment.
Well, my sister's making dinner, so I should go home.
Oh, well,
but,
yeah.
Do they sell fries? Just buy fries myself?
They sure do.
Let me just get some fries.
Yeah, they're very good. Plug for Vera's there.
Nice. Okay, sold. Well, that's a good way to end it, talking about fries.
And, yeah, that was kind of like, you know, the Sean style of podcasting, really dark and depressing. So,
well, next time, if I get my stuff in gear with my new computer, which arrived yesterday, we might be able to podcast at my place next time.
That would be awesome. I'll bring the microphone over, the snowball. We'll test out the room.
Nice. Yeah, we'll see how it's probably going to be a different sound, eh?
The
different space kind of thing, so we'll see how that goes.
And so, yeah, well, thanks for listening, and check us out online. Where would they do that, Justin?
TheDotMatrix.com. Or on iTunes, search for The Dot Matrix. But that was episode 26. Nice.
Yeah, June 30th, 2009.
Nice. Well,
so, yeah.
We'll get it up as soon as we can. We were really good, then we were really bad on this one, and we'll be better this one, I'm sure. So.
That's right.
Cool.
Alrighty.
Okay, take care, all.
So long.